Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. According to the American Farmland Trust, 50 acres of prime agricultural land are paved over and developed every hour in North America. At the same time, the number of farmers is declining while the human population is expected to eclipse 8 billion in just over a decade. In order to feed ourselves in the future, many people are starting to consider urban agriculture as a piece of the puzzle of how future generations will continue to eat. This morning, we talk with Michael Abelman, one of the early visionaries of the urban agriculture movement, about Soul Food Street Farms, a network of four urban farms on 5 acres of reclaimed land in downtown Vancouver, B.C. In his new book, Street Farm, Growing Food, Jobs, and Hope on the Urban Frontier, he provides a glimpse into the promises of urban farming on a grand scale, both to grow fresh food sustainably and to begin to reclaim damaged human lives. Michael, welcome to Locus Focus.
So nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I always like to have an urban farmer on my show. Actually, urban farming or urban agriculture has become kind of a trendy term, and it seems like a lot of people are fancying themselves as urban farmers. In your book, you make a distinction between farming and gardening, and like myself, it seems like it's one of your pet peeves about people who call themselves farmers who are actually maybe growing a few tomatoes in their backyard. So let's start by talking about what you think is the difference between farming and gardening and why what you're doing on Street Farm in Vancouver, B.C. is actually farming.
Yeah, well, you're going to start off with the most controversial piece of my presentation. No, I started an organization in the early 1980s, which we called the Center for Urban Agriculture. And at that time, when you used the words urban and agriculture in the same sentence, you were looked at rather strangely. And now, of course, we have a major movement internationally around this. I think that I do have some trouble, and I think a lot of people who have worked in agriculture as farmers, and that has been my profession for the last 40-plus years, mostly on larger-scale open-field farms. When you've worked in that way and developed the skills to do agriculture, which are fairly complex and varied, I think a lot of people take a little bit of offense by people using the word agriculture to apply to something that is on garden-type scale. I mean, you know, if you just once changed your oil or do change your oil, you wouldn't call yourself a mechanic. If you acted in the school play, you're not necessarily an actor. And agriculture requires a lot of years of careful observation, development of all kinds of skills. And it is the language that I'm talking about. I think the smaller scale garden production units are very important to the food security of our communities and certainly our cities. And this is not a value judgment, but I think that it's just a matter of our use of language. And so I'm very careful about using agriculture unless it is truly on a production scale that suggests producing volumes of food and jobs. Those are the two things that I consider to be agricultural.
Well, actually, a concern that I have about there being a confusion between being a farmer and being a gardener. I mean, I know of situations in Oregon where people who probably were still gardeners who thought of themselves as farmers and started CSAs. And there was one case where the CSA went belly up and they stiffed all their shareholders. And that gives a very bad name to people who are running very responsible CSAs and who are actually farmers. So maybe there should be some way, I'm thinking, some kind of an accreditation, but that people should really, what does it take to get people to understand the real skills it takes to be a farmer, maybe before they start taking on that mantle themselves?
Well, I think, there's no question. If you were in, for example, in Europe, there's for many of trades, whether it's being a carpenter, a plumber, a cabinet maker, or a farmer in many cases, there are many levels that you go through before you can actually call yourself such, And people train for many, many years to do this work well. I'm not sure what happened that people perceive that if you just have the right clothes and the right tools, that you can call yourself a farmer. I don't know that that's, I think, it is, again, a highly complex profession that requires a lot of years of training to do well. And again, like any profession, there's various levels of how people carry this out. But I also would say that I'm really happy that people want to be farmers. I would just suggest that they take the time and learn how to do it well so that their chances of success are better insured.
Well, I wonder, too, if some of this has to do with our disconnection from our food sources. And you talk about that in the book, about how most people in North America think of food as something that arrives, you know, in a supermarket and then to their plate, and don't have much of a sense of connection to how it's grown or who's growing it. And do you think that if we were better connected to the actual people who grow our food and learn more about what it takes to do that, that we might take the term farmer a little more seriously?
There's no question. I mean, I think that you know, we're living in a time where I'd like to say we're just beginning to come out of almost a total disconnection from how food comes to us and to the natural cycles related to that, to an understanding of how to work with soils and do the basic tasks that are required to bring food to us. There's 1.5-2% of the population that are growing the food for the rest. And I think that, I like to say that I don't really see that there's so much a food crisis as there is a crisis in participation. And as such, when people are not connected with the process, then it's very hard for them to know where to start, how to engage in it. I think this is all shifting dramatically. And certainly, you know, where you are in Portland, Oregon is kind of a hotbed of all this. And pretty much everywhere there is a real shift taking place. I guess what I wonder sometimes is how much of it is real and deeply rooted and lasting, and how much of it is fad. And I think there's probably a little bit of both, is what I suspect.
Well, I'm thinking about all my neighbors that were raising chickens about 4 or 5 years ago. And I was thinking about it the other day and realized nobody has chickens in my neighborhood anymore.
That's great.
Well, I mean,
I've kept probably 100 laying birds for the last almost 40 years of my life, you know. And while I, you know, I have mixed feelings about chickens, the benefit they provide for any farm, and certainly the fantastic protein source that they generate, it's really a wonderful addition, but some of their habits are rather strange. You know?
Well, actually, I mean, I raised chickens when I lived in the country. I had chickens for about 3.5 years, and I loved them, and there definitely were a lot of challenges. I started out thinking, well, it's about like raising cats, because, you know, you have to feed them twice a day, and they can go off on their own, and they can feed themselves a lot, and then there's the thing, you have to, like, cats, you flea comb them with chickens, you have to deal with lice and other stuff and powder them every so often. But I think in the city, there's a big difference between having chickens and having cats. And one of my neighbors, actually, their chickens, they had no yard. And you see these chickens walking in the middle of the intersection, which was kitty corner from the post office. So there was, a lot of people.
I love that image. You know, I was, when I farmed in California, I was on this wonderful farm down there for 25 years that became surrounded by suburban development. And I was at one point threatened by the district attorney with jail time over the crow of my roosters. It became a big international story. This is going way, way back, 25, 30, more than 30 years ago now. So so when when we talk about urban chickens, I have to laugh, because we spent many, many months fighting what was really quite a remarkable battle, which was simply the idea that we could actually keep chickens and roosters, which are an essential part of the flock, in an area that had become so completely suburbanized around us. You know?
So, in Portland, you can't have roosters, though. You can have, I think, up to 5 or 6 chickens now. But I think
this was an actual farm that was there, had been there for 100 years.
You should have a little bit of a grandfather clause, I would think, for your roosters. I had a couple neighbors that had roosters about 4 years ago. And actually, from having spent the time with my own flock back in the 70s, I love this. I mean, I don't always like being woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning by a rooster. And you learn when you have them that it's a myth that they actually crow at dawn, except when to crow in the middle of the night. So there was a nice feeling about it. But I can also understand why people don't want to have roosters in the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it might also be an indication of some of the challenges of farming in the city that need to be really understood before you, which let's get to the differences between farming in the city and farming on rural land. And what are the, because your farm in particular strikes me, I've been around a lot of urban farming. And in fact, we just finished a movie about farming, which includes an urban farm in Richmond, California, which has some parallels to Soul Farm and some real strong differences. But there are certainly big challenges to farming in a city. And I was curious about the fact that you, not only do you have raised beds, which a lot of urban farms do, but you seem to mostly do your farming on pavement.
Yeah, so first of all, just to give you some context, this is a urban farm on a grand scale. We are farming on 4+ acres. We're producing 25 tons, that's 25 tons of food annually, employing up to 30 people, most of whom are managing some form of addiction or mental illness, because we're operating in a neighborhood that is the neighborhood called the Downtown East Side. It's where the term Skid Row was actually coined. And we're doing this on parking lots and land that was deemed too contaminated to actually grow. And I should remind your listeners that most urban soils everywhere in the world, urban native soils are now too contaminated to grow in. It's very rare to find any that are not. And so we've developed a pretty innovative system using these boxes that we designed and manufactured. We have almost 10,000 of them, which actually isolate the growing medium from either pavement or contaminated soil, and also allow us to move on short notice, which is another major challenge in every urban area because land values are so high. And so this is a movable system. It is a safe growing system. But there are numerous other obstacles and challenges that are inherent in any urban environment, especially if you're going to operate on the scale that we're operating on. Theft and vandalism, municipal codes, which were never written to accommodate the kind of large-scale production agriculture in the city that we're doing. Limited space, lack of skills and knowledge to do this, that's a big one, certainly. There's numerous challenges, but if one is willing to face those, the rewards are pretty fantastic. You have a natural market, a large market surrounding you. You have the ability to employ people. So there's a lot of benefits to growing food in the city.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Michael Abelman, who's author of a new book, Street Farm, Growing Food, Jobs, and Hope on the Urban Frontier. And we're talking about his rather expansive urban farm in Vancouver, B.C., called Soul Food Street Farms. How did this project start? Because you have a farm, on Salt Spring Island, and you are you're a farmer out in the countryside. So what brought you into the city to do urban farming?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, I had been I had farmed in California for many years, and then moved north. We've been on our family farm on Salt Spring Island. It's 120 acres, so it's a fairly significant project. But after a few years, I kind of felt like I wanted to get back in the trenches. When I was in the States, I had started projects in places like Watts in Los Angeles and had started the Center for Urban Agriculture and was fairly active and involved and was ready to do more of that. And at the same time, I received a call from some folks on the Downtown East Side. They wanted to do something agricultural. They had no experience or skills. They had a half-acre parking lot next to one of the boarding houses in the neighborhood. And I agreed to go to one meeting, which led to another. And before I knew it, I was helping design and vision and actually develop and run this project, which now after 8 years has grown and expanded to 4.5 acres. As I mentioned, 25 tons of food, 30 people employed. Primarily our focus is, it's not just an agricultural one, it's a social focus, because our primary goal was to provide meaningful employment to individuals who previously had been deemed as they say, hard to employ, mostly because of mental illness and addiction issues. And so that has been our primary goal and focus. The agricultural goals, of course, are there as well. We wanted to actually provide a what I call a credible model of urban agriculture, one that was truly agricultural. But we wanted to do it with the hands of folks who did not have these kinds of opportunities. And that's been the most exciting part of this, I think.
I'm curious about this neighborhood they call Downtown East Side. And when a lot of us think of Vancouver, B.C., we think of this gleaming city with lots of high rises. Actually, unfortunately, very few old neighborhoods, which I remember well from the 70s. But it's a city that seems to be one of the most prosperous cities in North America. And so your description in your book of the Downtown East Side, which is a neighborhood which probably most people don't even know exists in Vancouver, I'm wondering how many people who live in Vancouver are aware of this neighborhood and what it's like.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. I mean, first of all, you're right. Vancouver is now one of the most expensive, most prosperous cities in North America, and some people would say even in the world. But not everyone participates in that prosperity. And so side by side, you have this gleaming steel and glass high-rises next to a neighborhood that is literally the poorest postal code in the entire country. And So it's, you know, the neighborhood, the Downtown East Side, is about a 15-square-block area, almost entirely inhabited by folks who are dealing with mental illness and drug addiction. It has some of the highest rates of drug overdose, HIV, open prostitution. If you were to walk down the streets or the back alleys of this neighborhood, even in broad daylight, you would see individuals with needles in their arms or someone pirouetting in the middle of the street high on crack. And like most of us, you know, I think we all come to those experiences with some form of prejudice and judgment. And yet I have discovered that those same individuals have intelligence and creativity and hearts and souls and the desire to do something meaningful in the world. And the work that we started with the farms was merely to provide a meaningful engagement, a reason for someone to get out of bed each day, a community of people to participate with. You know?
Now, this neighborhood... Well, this neighborhood is... from the pictures that in your book, which are wonderful and very, very explanatory, it looks like it's a neighborhood that's crisscrossed by overpasses and parking lots and lots of highways around it. And it kind—I'm not sure. Many years ago, I walked from, I guess it was the bus station to the Canadian National Railroad station as I was about. I came up from Oregon and I was going to cross the country. On the train. And I just remember a lot of viaducts and things which I don't think are there anymore. But I'm having a sense that, that's the neighborhood. It's in there between the bus station and the railroad and the train station, and that it's an area that is, on the one hand, like really close to downtown and really close to a lot of attractions. And on the other hand, it's kind of this area that nobody notices.
Yeah, that's a good, pretty good description. You know, it's the neighborhood where the term Skid Row was coined, and which is actually a logging term.
I thought that was in Portland, actually.
Well, you know, everybody, this is so funny because I've heard that from somebody from Seattle as well. Yeah. So
I think they all were coined simultaneously.
I'm not sure that any of us should feel proud to say that.
Well, in Portland,
but nonetheless, it is. It's interesting because it's also now a neighborhood, even since this book has been written, that is in such rapid transition. That even some of the descriptions that are in the book would be not quite so easy to find. The many of the inhabitants of this neighborhood are being pushed to other parts of the, you know, the edges of the neighborhood as the old rundown buildings are torn down and real estate prices are so valuable that they're being replaced with more high rises and high-end restaurants. And so it is a neighborhood in transition. But it is also still, to this day, home for many people who have nowhere else to go. And so it has some some of the highest levels of social service agencies you'll find anywhere in the world concentrated there. It's a fascinating place. And so, as somebody mentioned to me, you know, in many ways, when you walk through this neighborhood, there is a sense of community there that in some cases you wouldn't find in some of the more expensive neighborhoods in this area. It's remarkable. People really look after each other. So it has some wonderful qualities.
Well, it seems that a lot of urban farms that are serious they're more than about growing food. And that's definitely the case in yours. It's in Detroit, it's certainly important. And when you look at the places that are centers for urban farming, like Detroit, like Richmond, California, Oakland, California, Portland to some degree, and your farm here, there seems to be a social need that is being met more creatively by farming, perhaps, than other ways that people have tried to reach these populations. So how does your project reach out to people, and how do you see it as being more than just teaching people how to farm? And what do they learn, actually, about life and about themselves and about responsibilities of being in a community through learning how to farm?
That's a good question. Yeah, you know, I'm very clear in the book that we are not psychologists, we're not social workers, we're not addiction experts. We're merely farmers that essentially, as I describe it, have kind of set the table for something positive to happen. You know, when I got into this was not some sort of noble attempt to save anyone. Even in many ways, our focus has not been to even get people off of drugs. It was merely an opportunity to give people meaningful work and to train people to do that work. The results of that have been really profound, I have to say. We do very intentional training sessions, not just on agriculture, although that's certainly a big focus, because, you know, we're supplying many of Vancouver's top restaurants, so the quality of the food has to be very high. So we're training people to work on farms at a very high level. But we're also training them in financial literacy, driving courses, nutrition, cooking, a whole range of opportunities that we're providing. There's a breakfast program. And really what we have attempted to do is to create some sense of community on the farms, a place where people really would feel like they had a reason to get up in the morning, right? And plants to take care of, you know, soil that depended on them, a neighborhood that was dependent on them for its food, I think the results of having that level of responsibility, without any particular social training or psychology training, has really provided results that we never would have expected. We have individuals now working with us for over 7 years that never held a job for 7 months. We have individuals who were, one person in particular came to us, a hardcore crack addict who is now one of our supervisors and an exceptional farmer, highly skilled after just 6 or 7 years. So, yeah, I mean, I think the stories of the people in the book and how where they came from and how this work has affected them, I think, is probably the most inspiring piece of it.
I'm just thinking there's a person in our film, Doria Robinson, who runs this program, Urban Tilth, in Richmond, California, which is a 12 or 13 gardens and farms across the city, mostly in really hard-hit areas. And it's a lot of youth training. And I think a difference between their program and your program is that there's much more of a focus on young people, high school age and just out of high school, and that there's not maybe people who are quite as far down the path of life of dysfunction as the people that you're working with. But she says that one of the strong parts of their program is that teaching people how to grow vegetables is the best project management training you can get. And then she describes, you know, basically, if you don't water your plants, they're going to die. You know, it's like it's very black and white about what happens if you don't follow through. And I'm wondering if you're seeing the same thing, if you see this is like really great project management training.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, working with living soil and plants and actually growing nutrition for someone else is the lessons involved on a day-to-day basis are unbelievable, you know. You know, the whole cycle from planting a seed, I mean, I've done it a million times, and the miracle of it is still present every time I see it, you know. That alone, you know, every time you see a seed germinate and emerge, you know. The physical and physiological impacts of working with living soil, I mean, most of us who've been doing this work for a long time have known kind of anecdotally that at the end of a day playing in the dirt, we just simply feel better. And now there's a lot of studies, well-documented studies, that demonstrate that living soil and working with it have profound impacts on mental health and well-being, you know, and serotonin levels and all kinds of physiological things that happen. Being at the market, I mean, you know, one of our probably our best policies that we put into place at the beginning was that every farmer's market, and we do several a week, we required one or two members of our downtown Eastside crew to be front and center, engaging with the public, handing out samples, talking about the food. And that forces them to engage socially in an environment they normally would not or would be somewhat uncomfortable with. And it forces the public to deal with their own stuff about taking a sample from someone who maybe doesn't look like a farmer or who they normally would not engage with. That piece has been fantastic. So, I mean, there's so many elements of this that are inherently healing and positive. And so when I hear staff members who talk about this far more eloquently than I do, talk about their experience and how they show up at work not feeling well and leave feeling so much better, I begin to understand that there's something going on here on so many levels that is nothing that we did for anyone. They did it for themselves in many respects, you know. So.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Michael Abelman, who is a farmer, and he's author of Street Farm, Growing Food, Jobs, and Hope on the Urban Frontier. And we're talking about this rather extensive urban agriculture project that he runs called Soul Food Street Farms.
S-O-L-E.
That's right. Where did that name come from?
Well, it's interesting. When we started almost 8 years ago, we started under a registered charity on the downtown east side called United We Can that runs the largest recycling center in BC, all with hundreds of street people who actually clean up the streets and alleys of bottles and cans and make money doing so. And so we were a project with them, and they had a little sub enterprise called Soul, Save Our Living Environment, and we kind of were put under that, and so we ended up being referred to as Soul Food. So that name has stuck. We since, of course, have gone off and formed our own charitable organization that owns the project. So.
Well, kind of like the image of, like, you know, thinking about the soles of our feet as kind of being how we get rooted to the ground, and so there's a nice connection there. As opposed to the
really
SOU.
Somebody brought that up in another interview. It's funny, I had never thought of that, you know, so it's good.
Yeah, and then, of course, there's the pun with soul, S-O-U-L, so it seems to work both ways. Well, my opening remarks this morning were kind of lifted from your publicist, and there's this, so we started out talking about the possible need for urban agriculture as a way to feed us in a planet that's growing in population and shrinking in arable land or food, the land that's being used for producing food. And in fact, there's a crisis here in Oregon, I think across the United States, in terms of agricultural land that's not growing food anymore, that's being used for other kinds of crops that certainly don't serve the local community. So what role do you think that urban agriculture can play in actually feeding the planet?
Well, first of all, I want to say right up front that I have no illusions that urban farms are going to feed our cities. I think a much more, and there is a lot of romanticism about this, I think a much more intelligent conversation is how do urban farms integrate with peri-urban and rural farms? What is best to grow where? How do they fit together? To view urban farms not as isolated enterprises, but as part of a broader integrated food system, I think is a much more sane, intelligent, and practical, pragmatic way to look at this. So when we look at it that way, then we see that that urban farms provide a particular and somewhat narrow piece in the broader food system package. Certainly, as we discussed, urban farms are very important from a social, psychological, and education perspective because urban dwellers need to see how food is grown. They need to participate in some fashion. And if they're on the scale that we operate on, urban farms can, in fact, provide some very significant job opportunities and training, as well as production food, but not all food. I mean, we are, even on the scale we're operating on with Soul Food Street Farms, we limit our production to things that make sense on those 4 acres and within the context of the physical box system that we're using to grow. I really feel that that we have a responsibility as urban farmers and all farmers to have the conversation that says, okay, so what makes sense to be doing where, and how do we feed into each other's systems? You know, I think this is really important. It's important from a food perspective and how we feed our cities. It's also important from a nutrient cycling perspective, because one of the things that's really problematic is that the cycling of nutrients between farms and the urban areas that they supply has essentially been interrupted. Those nutrients do not, the waste never returns to those farms, you know. And so how, you know, that's a really fascinating piece of this that I think is worthy of our conversations.
So where do you get your compost from?
Yeah, so I mean, in our case, we are now making compost. We had originally planned to make all of our compost, but because of restrictions, municipal restrictions, on doing so and where we could get away with doing so, we have only been able to do a limited amount of that. So we rely on, we're fortunate to have regional sources of compost that we actually have, you know, we purchase materials from in order to supply our system. You know, that's the other thing about much urban agriculture, and especially in our case, you could never ever view the way we are farming in the city in those boxes on pavement as I do view my own farm, my own 120-acre farm, where we try to see it as a self-contained, self-feeding organism where its nutrient cycle is as much contained from within as possible. Cover cropping and, you know, the use of livestock and long-term rotations, all those things are very difficult, if not impossible, in the city. So we are, in the city, we are reliant on other creative systems, and hopefully those nutrient systems are depending to some degree on the local neighborhoods, but that's a difficult piece.
So how do you do it? I'm kind of curious. I mean, where do you get your compost from, and do you, I mean, you obviously can't do much crop recycling, crop rotation, but maybe...
Very difficult, yeah.
Yeah, maybe you could do some.
I mean, both the crop rotations... certainly, we do have a crop rotation system. You know, we can do that. Certainly, you know, on a 4 acre, 4+ acre system, you can do some of that, but nowhere near what we should be doing in order to really do it appropriately. Certainly, you can't do long term crop rotations on that scale. And composting, as well as I said, is the percentage of compost that we produce ourselves relative to what we have to purchase is quite small. You know, we just don't have the space, and municipal restrictions keep us from doing it to the degree we would like, you know. So we rely on concentrated things like, for example, worm castings, compost teas, some limited cover cropping, because cover cropping requires integrating those cover crops, and the physical challenges of that in the box are difficult, you know. Mulching, we do some of that. In that case, we have to purchase in spent alfalfa hay, for example. We have people in the region who are making compost, and we do have to buy compost from time to time. And we have to use some mineral fertilizers, you know, rock dust, and in some cases, feather meals. So it's kind of a mismatch of whatever we can pull together, and it is also, in a box, very difficult to maintain organic matter content because it tends to burn up quite quickly, unlike in an open field situation. So.
One of the things that really struck me is what you grow, and you do extensive use of season extensions devices like the hoop houses, but also, I mean, you grow these melons and tropical fruit and I mean, stuff that actually I have some of that stuff growing in my compost heap, but by accident, but it doesn't really take. So I wonder, how do you grow these things in Vancouver? You're 140 miles north of us, and we have a lot of trouble growing that stuff in Portland.
Well, we planted a 1 acre orchard in boxes at the corner of Main and Terminal, one of the busiest intersections in Vancouver. It's been 5 years ago, I think it is. Within three years, that orchard, by the way, included things like quince, persimmon, Meyer lemon, fig, and then of course apple, pear, cherry, plum. But what was really remarkable was that there was complete disbelief in the possibility, for example, of having producing persimmons in Vancouver, British Columbia, and yet last year. Off of trees that are less than 4 years old, we harvested over 500 pounds of beautiful ripe persimmons. This year we will have another crop of those, and when those persimmons ended up in the kitchens of local chefs, of course the other growers who saw those accused us of purchasing them from Chinatown. Nobody believed it. But it is possible, and one of the benefits of growing these trees in raised boxes is that the roots get a lot more heat, the drainage is quite good, the soils are quite rich. The growth rates are unbelievable in those boxes for trees. And of course you have the benefit of just the general urban heat sink, so there's a little more warmth within the city than there would be in a typical farm environment in this region. So it's figs have done quite well. This year we had thousands of dollars of figs stolen, including the leaves from the trees, which are quite usable in various culinary traditions. So that was hard. Last year
not
we
to mention
had our
clothing,
whole apple
right?
crop stolen. So.
So that actually gets to another issue. I mean, you touched upon this in the beginning of the show, that there are some real security issues that you have to face.
Yes.
And it's the same thing is true with Urban Tilth in Richmond. They've had their tools ripped off. They've been trying to train the neighbors for several years to pick the fruit. I mean, their gardens are open. Some of the gardens are totally open. They're on the greenway that goes through the inner city of Richmond. But their motto is pick the fruit, not the tree, because they've had entire trees uprooted and tomato plants. So how do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, we don't take it personally. We know when someone is dope sick or needs a fix, they will do whatever is necessary to deal with that. It's not a personal thing. It's our responsibility to keep stuff secure. But the reality is that anything that is not bolted down will disappear. We've had an entire cooling system from a truck removed in a single night. The wires, live power wires from the inflation fans on our greenhouses removed, computers and anything that is left unsecured has disappeared. And, we did, a few years ago, we hired a wonderful man from the neighborhood also, Mike Devine, to be the night watchman at this one site that we have, which is below the First Avenue Bridge. It's 16,000 square feet of high tunnel, unheated greenhouses. We were having terrible theft problems there. And something remarkable happened. We, for some reason, discovered that the theft and the vandalism started to taper off to nothing. And when I asked Mike about it, I discovered a couple of things. Number one, he requested a headlamp so that rather than just standing around at night, he could actually be working. So he was in there weeding and cultivating by headlamp. And when someone would show up to do us harm or to steal from the place, instead of running them off, he merely stopped and took the time and described to them what we were doing. And that, in fact, the people we were serving were their people. It was people from that neighborhood. And little by little, as people began to understand what was going on there, the theft and the vandalism tapered off. And I think I tell that story in the book. I think it's really a remarkable piece And I don't mean to be idealistic or romantic about the possibilities here. Again, it still remains that if someone's in trouble, they will do whatever they have to take care of their addictions, you know. But the story points out the importance of what can happen when someone from that community is willing to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, you know. When you're stealing from us, you're stealing from your own people, you know. You're taking money out of the pockets of folks that, are just like you, you know. And that has really shifted things.
Well, Michael, I wish we could talk much longer because there's a lot more I'd like to talk to you about. So maybe we'll continue this conversation some other time.
I'd love that, yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, well, we will be in touch. We've been talking with Michael Abelman, who's farmer and author of Street Farm, Growing Food, Jobs, and Hope on the Urban Frontier. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locustfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Matt Little with Cascade Forest Conservancy about a proposed gold mine on Mount St. Helens. My engineer has been Kathleen Stevenson, and our new Public Affairs Director Derek Crooks. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. We're going to go out with some music by Eshel Eldridge from Berkeley, California. This was the theme actually for the film that we did. It's called Green the Block.
Yeah. Yeah. Urban tilth. You grow your own, you know what I'm saying? Get down and dirty with it. If you grow it, they gon' eat it. Yeah. Watch it, watch it, watch it grow, yeah. Watch it, watch it, watch it grow, yeah. Watch it, watch it, watch it grow, yeah. Watch it, watch it, watch it. Till the earth and drop the seed down. Grow your own and tell me how you feel now. Till the earth and drop the seed down. Grow your own and tell me how you feel now. All in my pocket, at harvest time, gon' clock it. No GMOs, no high fructose, no Cheetos going in my rocket. Yeah, living out of their system. Illness come, we resist them. No shots of flu, who they talking to? Like they know I grow my prescriptions. More green for the team, better grow that. No food on the block, better grow that. Cops lock, try to stop that, know that. Do good for the hood, don't go back to the prison where they hit them like low jack. In the middle of the street where we plant that. Medicine be the light like Edison. No insulin, that's the evidence. Green the block, green the block, green the block, green. Green the block, green the block, green the block, green. Green the block, green the block, green the block, green. Green the block, green the block, green, green. Till the earth and drop the seed down. Grow your own and tell me how you feel now. Till the earth and drop the seed down. Grow your own and tell me how you feel now. The parking spots and backyards, we hack hard. The soil is the soul, and this garden's where I meet God. This labor is my lover, the earth is my cover. Plant the justice with fat beats, drop the seeds to be crack street. From interlocks to parking spots and backyards, we hack hard. The soil is the soul, and this garden's where I meet God. This labor is my lover, the earth is my cover. Plant the justice with fat beats, drop the seeds to be crack streets. Watch it grow, watch it grow, watch it grow, yeah. Watch it grow, watch it grow, watch it grow.